Felt like the Lord put it on my heart to spend a little time looking at the life of Joseph. And I guess if you can call it confirmation, my wife stepped into my study at one point in the last few days and looked at what I was doing. She said, "Oh, that's my favorite Old Testament person." Okay, well, maybe I'm on the right track. But anyway, if you want to turn with me to Genesis 29. Joseph, as you can see here, was the 11th of Jacob's 12 sons. And I think we'll find that there's a lot of encouragement in Joseph's life. We don't want to rehash too much of what people have gone over before, but I think there's a lot of encouragement that we'll find in Joseph's life, and we'll see it even in his beginnings as we look a little bit at his family tonight. Just as a little bit of background, in case you've never tried to decipher this, Jacob was the grandson of Abraham. Abraham's brother was Nahor. He was the grandfather of Laban, who was the father of Jacob's wives, Leah and Rachel. And if you look at the breakdown, Abraham and Nahor were brothers. That made Isaac and Bethuel cousins. Okay? Isaac was Abraham's son, and Bethuel was Nahor's son. Isaac took Rebekah, who was Bethuel's daughter, as his wife. And from that then, we have Jacob, who was Isaac's son, and Rebekah's brother, Laban, was Bethuel's son. Isaac wound up marrying two of Laban's daughters. So when you look at Isaac and Bethuel, they were cousins, and I'm not sure quite what that makes then Jacob and Laban's two daughters, if that makes them second cousins or first cousins, second removed. I never have understood that terminology. But anyway, Jacob wound up marrying the daughters of a man who was of basically the same generation as he was, for what it's worth. Okay, Jacob's name, as you probably know, means supplanter. And if you go to the dictionary, a supplanter is one who replaces, displaces, or supersedes another. In other words, they oust, unseat, or take the place of another by subterfuge. That means skullduggery. Fancy words that basically means you're being sneaky. Okay? Let's have somebody go to Romans 8, someone to 2 Corinthians 5, someone to Galatians 3. And what we have here is obviously a picture. Jesus, who is the second Adam, took the place of the first Adam in this way. And whoever's in Romans 8, verse 3.
"For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin, condemned sin in the flesh."
Okay, so God sent his Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. Doesn't mean he himself was sinful. He just looked like us. Okay? He became one of us. 2 Corinthians 5, whoever's there, verse 21.
"For he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him."
Okay? So again, in another way, on the cross, the Lord was made that sin that we were, and we were given his righteousness in return. Galatians 3, whoever's there, verse 13.
Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone that hangs on a tree. Excuse me.
Okay, he was made our curse, much the same as what we just read there in 2 Corinthians. And then in chapter 4, Carolyn, verses 4 and 5.
But when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons.
Okay, so again, he was made one of us, he was made of a woman, to take our place and to take our punishment. So, because Jacob did this, this supplanting more than once, I'll add, by faith, the Lord renamed him Israel. And that's number 3478 in the Strong's Hebrew, if you want to look it up. And let's have somebody go to Matthew 11. That name Israel means he who persists, contends, or struggles, that is, wrestles with God. Now, on the surface, that might, your first thought might be, maybe that's not the smartest thing in the world to do. But as we're going to see, that is exactly the attitude and the approach that the Lord rewards. Whoever's in Matthew 11, verse 12.
And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent take it by force.
Okay. So the Lord here is saying that the kingdom of heaven suffereth, that it means to allow or permit, permits violence. And the word violence, if you want to look it up, it's number 971 in the Greek. And it not only means violence, it means to rush into or overpower. And it comes from number 970, which means life strength, life force, or life violence. And let's have somebody go to Ephesians 6, someone else to 2 Corinthians 12. And whoever gets to Ephesians 6, verse 10.
Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might.
Okay, so it's not our life strength or our life force, it's his that we are to be violent with, if you will. 2 Corinthians 12, whoever's there, verse 10.
Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches, in necessities and persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong.
Okay, and this again proves that it's not our life force or our life strength, it's his. Because it will only manifest itself and be effective when we recognize and, if I might say it this way, rest in our weakness or our inability. Okay? Going on, the phrase the violent there in that verse is number 973, and it means literally the strong, forceful, or violent ones. So, isn't that interesting? We're to be and recognize and rest in our own weakness, but at the same time, God sees us as the violent ones, the strong ones, that way. Okay? And then that word take there in Matthew is number 726, and it means to speedily seize or take to oneself by force. It denotes an open act of violence rather than something sneaky. All right? So it is very obviously when the Lord said, heaven permits violence and the violent take it by force, he means something very obvious, okay, and out in the open. Debbie?
Would you say that when the Holy Spirit
stirs up the whole meeting and we all run to the altar, that's a violent rushing in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Aren't we eager to get up there?
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Let's just hope that nobody, no poor person ever gets trampled by that crowd going up there. James?
Yes, I was just thinking in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, it says, down here in earth, it says, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh, because the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but spiritual, mighty through God.
Mighty through God.
And I was just trying to, I can understand that in earth, what's going on, and we're not wrestling with principalities. I can understand that in earth, but I was just trying to, you see, kind of picture that as far as the violence in that realm, You understand? That's the violence in the realm of heaven.
Well, let's think about that violence.
In heaven.
It's a very unique kind of violence. Mm-hmm. Because for one thing, it prefers others before itself. Isn't that interesting? It's violent. It's an overt, open sort of violence.
Uh-huh.
It's a speedy violence. In other words, it's fast. But it regards the other person before itself. So it has to be a violence based in love.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
Okay. Now think about this world for a second when we think about violence. Think about the times that you've seen maybe one of these big stores going out of business and they tell everybody that, okay, at 7 a.m. the doors are going to open. And you've seen the crowds outside. And they almost trample one another trying to get in and find the bargains. How about when there's unrest and you see looting? People are willing almost to kill one another just for an armful of material goods. That's the kind of violence that's pictured here. But it's different because it's a violence that's tempered by love. And we all know how deep that love goes, because I don't think there's anybody in here that wouldn't testify that there's nobody that you know that you want to see miss God's best. But see, that violence will press in to whatever it's after, not trampling on somebody else, but at the same time, not allowing anybody to get in front of them. You see? So it's a wonderful quality and characteristic. It has the love and the regard for others, but please don't try to get in my way. Okay? And here's the interesting part. It's not me that's going to get after you. It's him.
Yes.
If you get in my way. All right? Okay. Genesis 38 is the story of Tamar, which our pastor went over here not too long ago. And notice how violently Tamar was determined to have her inheritance. Nobody was going to shut her out of it. But when you read the details, my goodness, you can't help but blush what that girl did to get in there. That's just inexcusable. I mean, talk about violating all the norms of society. It was violent. You see? But she was after something. Let's go over to the book of Joshua. I think there's three different instances of the same attitude of violence in Joshua. Starting in chapter 2, the first 21 verses are all about Rahab. And here again, Rahab was not shy. She hid the men on the roof, And when it was time to let him go, she says, hey, I got a deal to make with you. Okay, here's what I want. And they said, well, we can do that if you do this. But she said, here's what I want. Okay. Then in Joshua 14, we have another example. Starting in verse 6, the children of Judah came unto Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, said unto him, thou knowest the thing that the Lord said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to espy out the land, and I brought him word again, as it was in mine heart. You might want to underline that. It wasn't how things were to the natural eye. It's how things were in Caleb's heart. In other words, to the spiritual eyes, the eyes of faith. Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses sware on that day, saying, surely the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance and thy children's forever, because thou hast wholly followed the Lord my God. And now behold, the Lord hath kept me alive, as he hath said, these 45 years, even since the Lord spake this word unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. And now, lo, I am this day 85 years old, and yet I am as strong this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now, for war, both to go out and to come in. Now, therefore, give me this mountain whereof the Lord spake in that day. For thou heardest in that day how the Anakims were there, and that the cities were great and fenced. If so be that the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord hath said. Now here, again, was a violent heart. Caleb said, I was given a promise. Now, I'm here to redeem it. I want in. Now give me what the Lord promised me. Now I don't think there's anybody in here 85 years old. Okay. John Hill was a little over 85. And he's worked out all his life. And he could probably give any of us still a pretty good run for our money. But even that being the case, was Caleb relying here when verse 11, when he said, as my strength was then, even so is my strength now for war? Was Caleb relying on his physical prowess and stamina? No, he wasn't talking about that. He was talking about the strength of faith. The very same strength that 45 years before had enabled him to go into the land and see it through the eyes of faith. That's the only way he could say, even so is my strength now. Okay? An 85-year-old isn't as strong as a 40-year-old. Okay? So he was talking about faith. All right, let's look then in chapter 17. And starting in verse 1, there was also a lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph, to wit, from Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, because he was a man of war. Therefore he had Gilead and Bashan. There was also a lot for the rest of the children of Manasseh by their families, for the children of Abiezer, and for the children of Helek, and for the children of Asriel, and for the children of Shechem, and for the children of Hepher, and for the children of Shemida. These were the male children of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, by their families. But Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons but daughters. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahlah and Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they came near before Eleazar the priest, and before Joshua the son of Nun, and before the princes, saying, the Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our brethren. Therefore, according to the commandment of the Lord, he gave them an inheritance among the brethren of their father. And there fell 10 portions to Manasseh beside the land of Gilead and Bashan, which were on the other side Jordan. Because the daughters of Manasseh had an inheritance among his sons, and the rest of Manasseh's sons had the land of Gilead. These daughters were not going to be denied just because there were no boys in the family. Hey, we're heirs too. Give us our portion. Okay? There was violence there. The violence. The attitude of what's mine, I want what's mine. Okay? All right. So, again, this renaming of Jacob to Israel, in other words, one who persists, contends, or struggles with God, this was the declaration of God concerning Joseph's father. Okay? He was a wrestler. He was a contender. And obviously it was by faith. All right? But this was the declaration concerning Jacob, and thus it was Joseph's direct heritage. Okay? How many of us that have had children, every now and then somebody says, oh, your son or your daughter is just like you, and you kind of cringe. Like, don't say that. But this was Joseph's father, his dad. All right? This attitude of heart, this forwardness, this willingness to step in, if you will, and take things. I mean, you look at what he did. He didn't do it. Look what the Lord did with the cattle and the sheep when Jacob was working for Laban. Okay? Every time Laban turned around, Jacob wound up with the best of it. He confronted Jacob. Jacob said, look, every time you've tried to manipulate and get the best for yourself, they wind up on my side. I didn't do that. Okay? So this was Jacob's, not so much his personality, but it was his determination because he understood that God was for him. All right? And he may not have understood it first, but I think he came to realize that it wasn't something he had to try and finagle or manipulate or anything else. God was going to do it. If God told him, it was going to come to pass. He got his lesson real early with his mom. Remember? His mom said, now you go out and find some venison and bring it to me. We're going to dress it up. We're going to fool Dad. Well, can you imagine Jacob, you know, with the gravity of what they were about to do, to steal the birthright and the inheritance? Jacob had to have, you know, be a little, you sure you want to do this? But he quickly picked up on and grew into the faith that his mother exhibited. And then later in life, as the Lord manipulated things for Jacob, he was not hesitant to step into him and to pursue him. Okay? All right. Now, what I've done up here is put basically just a listing and a positioning of Jacob's family. These blue numbers here are the order in which these children were born. Dana came after Zebulun. She, as far as we know, was the only daughter born in the family. But this is the order in which they were born. Now, as Jacob seeks to begin his family, the Lord further saw fit to supply him with some real pieces of work. Okay? Wife number one, Leah, was the mother of six of his 12 sons. So she was the direct mother to half of the family. Leah's name, it's number 3812 in the Strong's Hebrew, and it comes from 3811. It means weary, impatient, or frustrated. One commentator says that her name means a wild cow. And I thought, boy, that's a real encouraging start. And on top of that, she wasn't the one that Jacob was after or expected on his wedding night. Okay? Her younger sister, Rachel, her name is number 7353. It means a ewe. She was the public object of Jacob's love. She was unable to bear children to Jacob until Leah had already borne 4 sons. So Rachel turned on Jacob and gave him her handmaid, who thus became one of Jacob's concubines. Now, that word handmaid is number 8198 in the Hebrew. Let's have somebody go to Ruth 2, and whoever gets there, read verse 13 for us.
Then she said, "Let me find favor in thy sight, my Lord, for that thou hast comforted me, and for that thou hast spoken friendly unto thy handmaid, though I be not wife unto one of thy handmaids, maidens."
Okay. Ruth called herself the same word, a handmaid. All right, to Boaz. Now, lest you find this strange, if you go back to Genesis chapter 16, the first 6 verses, you will find the story of Abraham and Sarah, where Sarah was unable to bear children, and she gave Abraham her handmaiden, Hagar. So this was not something new with Laban and Jacob. It was a well-established custom, if you prefer.
Scott?
Yes?
I was just reading that, and I wanted to know why she did that. So, like you said, it's not an accident.
Oh, no. No,
I just wanted to get you answering everything. I thought, why did she give her handmaid? That's interesting.
Well, see, again, customs that seem so strange and perhaps even distasteful to us, yet they were perfectly normal back then. Anyway, Rachel gave Jacob her handmaid named Bilhah. The name Bilhah is number 1089. It means decrepitude. Everybody know what decrepitude is? It means to trouble, frighten, terrify, tremble, or deter. In the Aramaic, it means to be weak in intellect. In other words, to be a bimbo. Okay, anyway, she became one of Jacob's concubines. The word concubine in the Old Testament, there's 7 or 8 occurrences of it. It's number 6370, if you want to look it up. It's always that word when you see concubine in the English. It's a mistress. In Judaism, she was a marital companion, in other words, a legitimate wife, of secondary rank, in other words, inferior status, who was socially subservient to her husband and his primary wife. And you see this in Genesis 16, where we were just a moment ago, 16:1-6, with Tamar. She was Sarah's handmaid. She became Abraham's concubine, but she was still socially subservient or inferior to both Abraham and Sarah. Okay? Somebody go to 1 Kings 11 and let's jump over to Judges chapter 19 for a moment. And we have an incident in Judges 19 of something very similar. Judges 19 starting in chapter 1. And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel that there was a certain Levite sojourning on the side of Mount Ephraim who took to him a concubine out of Bethlehem, Judah. Now, this means the fact that it's a concubine, the man already had a wife. All right? And his concubine played the whore against him and went away from him unto her father's house to Bethlehem, Judah, and was there 4 whole months. And her husband arose. That's the same man. And went after her to speak friendly unto her and to bring her again, having his servant with him and a couple of asses. And she brought him into her father's house. And when the father of the damsel saw him, he rejoiced to meet him. Now, was that the first time dad and son-in-law had ever met? I don't know. Kind of sounds like it. And his father-in-law, okay, she was a wife, although a secondary wife. And his father-in-law, the damsel's father, retained him. And he abode with him 3 days, so that they did eat and drink and lodge there. Okay? So here again, you have a portion showing that the concubine, even though she was a secondary wife and subservient, she was still treated as a wife. All right? And then whoever's in 1 Kings 11, verse 3.
And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart.
Okay, that's talking about Solomon. And the reason I bring that passage out is it makes a clear distinction between princesses, wives of the first rank, and concubines. They were not the same. Okay? If a man took a concubine, it was clear that she was a concubine, not a wife. But she still had the wifely status. It just wasn't the same status as the wife status. If that makes any sense.
Did they have a party?
What's that?
Like, did they get married?
They had to. Otherwise, they could have been called husband and wife.
So Solomon, he just had parties almost every day.
Yeah.
About every 2 weeks.
And that particular verse really brings into question how wise a man Solomon was. Yeah.
Turn away his heart.
700 wives and 300 concubines. Holy cow. All right. So up to this point where Rachel gives Jacob her handmaid Bilhah, all this has taken place in the first 8 verses of Genesis 30. Let me get back there. Okay. Now, not to be outdone, Leah, who had stopped being fertile for the time being, gave her handmaid Zilpah to Jacob. Zilpah's name is number 2153. It means flippant mouth. In other words, a smart mouth. It also means to drip or trickle. That's real picturesque, isn't it? Well, anyway, Zilpah bare Jacob 2 sons who were followed by 2 more sons and a daughter born to Leah herself. And you find this in verses 14 through 21. Finally, now, if you add up all these children, let's see, those 4, and then 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then Dinah. Okay, so we've got 11 children, and even though they were born to 3 different women, who, I'll give you, some of them could have been pregnant at the same time. We've got 11 times 9 months. And even if they overlapped a little bit, Rachel was barren for probably at least 7, 8, 9 years. Okay, to start. All right. But finally, it was Rachel's turn, and she then bore Jacob's last 2 sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And as the dust temporarily settles. Jacob now has 4 wives, 12 sons, 1 daughter, and a household full of drama. How many in here know somebody that was the product of a broken household? In other words, they had stepsisters, stepbrothers. Anybody know anybody like that? Okay. Did they ever talk to you, Walt, about how everybody got along?
They were on Jerry Springer.
Enough said. Look at this household. You've got 6 brothers who were born of Leah, and their attitude was backed up by their grandfather. It's not the custom of our people to give the younger before the older. Mm-hmm. We're the sons of the proper woman, the firstborn. Sure. You know, we're the legitimate ones here.
Why am I?
But then you've got followed by these two down here, who Jacob was their father, just like he was the father of these. And yet, think about this. These two and these two. They were the children of the concubines. Jacob was their father, so he no doubt loved them just like he did his other sons. From Jacob's viewpoint, he probably didn't see any difference. But when it came time, from this viewpoint and this viewpoint, do you suppose there was any conflict as to who they were loyal to? I mean, this woman is the one that went through the valley of shadow of death for these two, and same thing here. She was their real mom. And yet, society and law and everything else saw those two women as their real mom. Do you suppose that caused any conflict in here? I.e., jealousy? Resentment? Okay. And then, finally, along come these two little snots. Right, Joe? The babies. Little jerks. And of course, all this time, remember, now, these two didn't come along for maybe as much as 8 or 9 years. They were the babies in the family. And, you know, again, Rachel, even though she was Jacob's favorite, she was the little sister and the one that was able to bear children last. And, of course, because of that, none of these others looked down on her and her two little snot-nosed boys.
I'm picking up that nobody wanted Leah in the first place.
Nobody wanted what?
Leah. Because how come her dad had to pawn her off?
That's a really rude term. You know? How dare you? I mean, just because Leah, if you read the story, not only, let's see, what was that here? Not only did her name mean weary, impatient, frustrated, or a wild cow, But according to the story, she wasn't exactly a raving beauty. But she was the firstborn.
Right.
And in his own way, Laban was every much the conniver and schemer that Jacob was.
Yeah.
So you got to look at it from Laban's standpoint, Sean. He's got two daughters, okay? This one's a 10, this one's about a 2.5. Okay? Jacob comes on the scene, and boy, you know, he's starry-eyed over the 10 over there. He's ready to go. But if Laban gives her to Jacob right away, he's stuck with this one. And who wants her? Right?
But
a wild cow? Who wants her?
He made a promise to Jacob to give, because that's...
Well, sure he did. Yeah, when Jacob complained about it. But Laban had an opportunity. Maybe it was the first opportunity that came along. He had an opportunity to pawn that one off.
That's not a good term to use anymore.
It was the custom of the country.
Right.
At least that's what Laban said.
But it makes sense because nobody wanted her in the first place. No. That's why.
What?
Well,
of course nobody wanted her. She was a wild cow. But since when was it a custom that you have to give the eldest daughter away before any of the others? How many guys in here married the oldest daughter? Okay, one or two. How many married not the oldest daughter? I think we've been violating the rules. Okay? Now, maybe that was the case. Maybe that was the case, that it was the custom. But if you read the account, it sounds awful suspicious, like Laban had an excuse to get rid of the wild cow, and he took it. That was the law of the land, according to Laban, on the spur of the moment.
That's right.
But Jacob was to blame, too. He was drunk.
It was what?
He was drunk and didn't even realize he had drunk. I mean, seriously, you're looking at a 10, you're never drunk, and you get 2.5, you're 10.
Well, of course he was drunk. What do you think they do on their wedding night? Anyway, think about all the interrelationships here, all the feelings that go on. Here's Reuben, firstborn. But he's the daughter of the wild, or the son of the wild cow. And he sure didn't wind up being the favorite. Joseph was the favorite. So what I'm getting at is, as we launch into Joseph's life, look at the hotbed of strife and contention. It was no doubt many times. I mean, obviously the boys got along among themselves, at least the ones of the same woman. But look at the strife and the potential for the strife and the contention there. And, you know, our society today, they talk about dysfunctional families. Here's the original dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
Okay? And, of course, I'm sure we all know somewhat of the problems and the issues that these dysfunctional families generate. The jealousies, the hatreds, the resentments, whatever. But what I want you to take away from this is Joseph, who is, in case you don't know, he is the best and or the most complete type of Christ in the Old Testament. Joseph came out of this cesspool.
Amen.
Now, Brother Scott, that could be why Dan was very, I mean,
mean, that's why he turned so evil and wicked. He probably, let's see, how can I explain it?
Well, it's not like he had any. It's not like he had any middle child syndrome or anything, was it?
Not like what?
He had any middle child syndrome or anything, was it?
No.
Yeah.
But they were all envious.
Yeah.
Of Joseph, I think that's why he's, you don't find him in Revelation. He was the worst one. To me, he had more anger in him than all the rest. Now, that's the way I'm looking at it.
Well, you know, according to psychiatric studies, middle children do have a lot of problems.
Yeah, a lot.
Okay. Now, the point of all this, those of you that have a Scofield Bible, turn to the page in between Malachi and Matthew. There's a page there called From Malachi to Matthew. Scofield gives a history here of what happened in between the two Testaments. And what I want you to notice this, in this, starting on the second page, about the middle of the page, I would encourage you to read both pages here, but remember, 400 years transpired between the end of Malachi and the coming of John the Baptist. But starting in about the middle of the second page, I want to read this. The problem was to keep alive this exalted ideal in the midst of outward persecutions and sordid and disgraceful divisions within. The organic means to this end was the synagogue, an institution which formed no part of the biblical order of the national life. Its origin is obscure. Probably during the captivity, the Jews, deprived of the temple and its rites, met on the Sabbath day for prayer. This would give opportunity for reading of the scriptures. Such meetings would require some order of procedure and some authority for the restraint of disorder. The synagogue doubtless grew out of the necessities of the situation in which the Jews were placed, but it served the purpose of maintaining familiarity with the inspired writings, and upon these, the spiritual life of the true Israel was nourished. But during this period also was created that mass of tradition, comment, and interpretation known as Mishnah, Gemara, Halakoth, Midrashim, and Kabbalah, so superposed upon the law that obedience was transferred from the law itself to the traditional interpretation. During this period also rose the two great sects known to the gospel narratives as Pharisees and Sadducees. Amongst such a people, governed under the suzerainty of Rome, notice, governed under Rome by an Idumean usurper, rent by bitter and unspiritual religious controversies, and maintaining an elaborate religious ritual, appeared Jesus, the Son and Christ of God. That's the whole point here. You've got this, again, this hotbed of every sort of yuck, but look what comes out of it. A Joseph. Okay? And I hope that serves as a good introduction to what we'll get into with Joseph. Now, before we quit tonight, I'd said that Joseph is the outstanding Old Testament type of Christ. But I want you to understand as we go into this, and let's have somebody go to Romans 5, someone to Colossians 2, and someone to Hebrews 8. But I want you to understand, because as we look at Joseph's life, we probably will wind up emphasizing the fact that he is the outstanding type of the Lord and the things that happened to him. But whether we do or we don't, I want you to know that types, figures, and shadows are always limited and or fall short of their antitypes for one simple reason. And that is, you're trying to use the imperfect to portray the perfect. Okay? So types, antitypes, and figures will always fall down. They will always fall down at some point for that reason. Okay? Now, Paul spoke of these representations more than anyone else. And I don't have all of them here, but in Romans 5, verse 14.
Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him that was to come.
Okay, Adam was the figure of him that was to come, that is Christ. Now, compared to Joseph, Adam wasn't a real outstanding type. About the only thing that he could claim in terms of being like Christ was he's the head of the creation. Okay? Colossians 2, verses 16 and 17.
Let no man therefore judge him in meat, or in drink, or in respect of an holy day, or of noon, or of the Sabbath days, which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ. Yeah.
Okay? All those things in the Old Testament were shadows.
Yes.
All right? Hebrews 8, whoever's there, verses 4 and 5. Someone have it?
For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern shewed to thee in the earth.
Okay. And then if you would, Sean, in chapter 9, verses 6 through 9.
Now when these things were thus ordained, the priest went away into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. But into the second went the high priest alone once every year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people. The Holy Ghost, this signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing, which was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices that could not be, and that did the service perfect as contained in the contents.
Okay, and then in chapter 10, verses 1 and 2.
For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with those sacrifices which they offer year by year continually make the comers thereunto perfect. For then would they not have ceased to be offered, because that the worshippers once purged should have had no more conscience of sins.
And then in chapter 11, verses 17 through 19.
By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure.
Okay. Now, again, these are just a few of the places that Paul uses a type or a shadow of a figure. But all of these that we read show the limitations of such devices. That being said, they still are very instructive and very inspiring to us as we study the Word of God. So, I hope that was a blessing to you, and we will carry on if the Lord carries.